How important would the press, for example, be as a source of information on stocks? Would reading the papers be an important part of the day?
Oh, very much so, yes. I mean, you had extremely good relations with the press. Obviously, part of your information process at the beginning of the day or the weekend was what had the papers said, what was the comment. But equally, the press used to come on to us to find out, you know, what interesting it had gone on, and used to release certain amounts of information. It was probably later than that, but certainly Patrick Sargeant had a tremendous market relationship with the major jobbing firms, and I suppose in his day he was one of the most famous financial journalists, or most influential financial journalists in the popular press, and I suspect that he would put down quite a lot of that information to his rapport that he had with the major jobbing firms.
Where would the journalists get you? Would they be waiting for you outside of the house, or would they come into the offices?
No, they would come into the offices, they would ring you up, they would ring you at home, they would be in many respects close personal friends. Patrick Hutler and my father were, I keep talking about my father, but not only, but simply as I remember him talking, but certainly Bill May and Copper and my father, Patrick Hutler, Kenneth Fleet, Patrick Sargeant, were, off the top of my head, just three people I can, three journalists, which they all cultivated, and they cultivated them. It wasn't a question of, you know, giving information for direct gain. It was a sensible, rational discussion of the marketplace, of stock, particular stocks within the market, of topical news and so forth, and it helped inform comment, and from the jobber's point of view it helped very much, you know, knowing what the press would view about particular stocks or particular markets or the economic situation or politics or so many things would help them make up their mind about the way the market would be going. They wouldn't always be right, but it was certainly a very necessary part of the information process.
Would the brokers use you for information on stocks?
Yes, certainly. I think we have to define what information you mean. Certainly, brokers at the very beginning, and I'm talking now really sort of the cult of the equity, knew really quite a small amount about the companies in which they dealt. There was no question about large research departments and so forth, or economic departments. Phillips and Drew were probably the first firm who really began to get an organized institutional approach to equities with analysis, company comment, and so forth. And then very quickly, many firms followed after it. The great brokers of the day had really introduced their equity business on the basis of bringing the company to the market. And I can remember, certainly, although it was before my time in the firm, there were so many new issues coming that a broker would come up and say, well, what was this company, XYZ Limited? And the partner on the book became so fed up with telling him that it was making widgets or making distributing oranges or whatever it was, he had printed out a little basic pro forma which said that the issued capital was so forth, that the price of the offer was X, that its main objectives and business was Y, that the directors were so forth. And he just simply handed it out to them. And this was regarded as such a wonderful innovation that here was this firm of jobbers who actually, you know, could give them some information about the company, and they rattled off with it, and I suspect on many occasions posted it to their clients, that it was the first sort of what was known as an intelligence department. And from that we grew our own little small research department, which of course was very quickly overtaken by the jobbers. So yes, in that specific way did brokers come to the market to ask jobbers about information? The answer was yes, they did, and we were very happy to give it to them because the more information that people had, and so forth. Insider dealing, if that's what you were getting at by the question, no, people did not reveal innermost secrets, but any market is about information, and I'm not going to say for a moment that insider information about companies, and you have to be very clear in your definition about what is inside information and what isn't, was clearly about, and that brokers and jobbers would swap information, most of which I suspect was well wide of the mark, but it was regarded as inside, and it all meant you had to take notice of it. You couldn't be a part of it. But I don't think that for a moment that I would ever say that did brokers come and say to my father or my uncle or anybody, is it my any jobbing firm, do you know about XYZ, is it going to be taken over next week? And if it was, well, you clearly wouldn't tell him. That was regarded as quite unacceptable, and you would probably not be in possession of that information. It wasn't nearly as crude as perhaps some people think about. Nevertheless, I equally think that the sort of resultant damage which was inflicted as a result of perhaps indiscreet information was nothing like as bad as it now is seen to be.
Mm. Why is that? Because fewer shares would be involved, or fewer smaller sums were involved?
I think smaller sums were involved, and there was certainly less financial pressure to take advantage of such information. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you told a partner that you thought something might be going to happen, or he told you that, you definitely did not take advantage of it. You didn't pile off and tell the crew or make a fast buck for yourself or do all the other things which apparently now seem to be part of commercial life.
Do any of the major takeovers of the period figure in your experience? For example, the GEC takeover of AEI in 1967. You say your father kept you away from the electrical book.
Well, I wasn't, funnily enough, that was a very good example. I was not allowed on the electrical book at the time. And I do remember that coming up on the screen, and there was a hushed silence, and unbelievable that this mega merger could have taken place, and an absolute pandemonium around the jobbers' pitches as people piled in to see what was happening, what the price was, and tremendous turnover developed in the shares thereafter, yes. But I wasn't involved in the pitch at the time, but I can remember watching it happen. Yes.
Would an episode like this be quite profitable for a jobbing firm, in that there'd be a lot of turnover in
Yes, jobs? I think it would be. You might start off on the wrong foot, that could be quite expensive, but it would generate tremendous turnover. You would work your way out of the position if it was adverse to start with. Then you get onto the right foot, and then, particularly if the merger was going through at the end of the day, it could be extremely profitable. Mm. Those things were, by and large, welcome. But in a sense that they were short term, because if you had a very good stock like GC and a very good stock like AEI, to lose one, to be left with one bigger stock, the sum of the two parts was never in the long term as good as the sum of the two parts individually, as it were. Mm.
Do any other takeovers figure in your experience?
Well, there must have been many takeovers which have occurred during the time, but I don't think anything which I could immediately fasten upon. I mean, they became increasingly more plentiful, rumours of them became, and they either happened or they didn't happen, and very much, they became a currency of the day. So I think it wasn't until really quite late on in my career that the takeovers of major companies became a threat. I mean, if you took what was considered to be an alpha stock, you could, by and large, guarantee that would not be taken over, and therefore you'd be safe to run a position on the bear tack in it. It wasn't until probably the 80s when, or the late 70s and the 80s, when alpha stocks became targets for major companies. I mean, it would have been inconceivable in my day that distillers, in the early days, that say a company like Distillers could have been a takeover target. By the time I finished on the stock exchange, if somebody had said that ICI was a takeover candidate, I mean, you couldn't sensibly say that it was not. Mm. I think that certainly made our business very much more difficult as a result of it.
Mm. Do you have any recollections of the effects of a collapse of a firm? For example, Rolls-Royce in February 1971, either
yes.
on the firm or on the stock exchange generally.
Yeah, so those early 70s were extremely interesting times. I mean, not only were individual firms finding it very difficult, we did on one day have three hammerings. I don't know whether people listening to this tape will be familiar with a hammering. It was it was three blows on with a gavel on the one of the waiters' desks, which would basically state that the partners of the firm, and they were read out with their full names, were unable to comply with their bargains, and it meant that from that moment on they were out of business, and that the relationship of the firm vis-a-vis any other stock exchange firm was frozen and would have to be unwound. And it was a very chilling moment, because it was always preceded by a certain amount of rumour as to, you know, whether or not there was going to be a hammering or whether there wasn't. It was always very difficult when it happened near settlement day, because you know another firm didn't know whether he'd have his bargain settled, and there was always the fear of the domino effect and one thing and another. And it was one of the features of the post-war period that I was involved in, was that the jobbers, by virtue of the fact that they had got themselves well organized, never ever allowed another jobber to be hammered. They always effectively stepped in and took them over. Now, that might have been an arranged rescue with the help of a broker who'd said, look, to Esmond Delacre or Hugh Merriman or my father, look, I think that so-and-so is in trouble. We don't want any problems. Do you think you could see your way to taking them over? And very, very often that was actually how things were done, and particularly in the gilt edge market between Aykroyd and Wed, they were very skillful at making sure that the smaller firms were rescued properly, so there was no, the integrity of the market was consumed. It was in the equity market, it was the same was done, but it was always a little bit more rough and ready. So the hammerings were always about brokers that I remember, but they were very dramatic, extremely uncomfortable, and involved a good deal of personal unhappiness and distress at the same time, with people losing their jobs. And it's one of the things which does leave a mark. And even to this day, when I hear people strike a piece of wood or in a public place, I just stop for a minute and think about the sort of death knell. It was rather like the rattle of the guillotine, if one's not being too romantic about it.
Did Pynchon ever suffer through the hammering of a broking firm?
Yes, temporarily we did, but in the event, we always got our money back from them, by and large. Mm.
Could you describe what would happen in those kinds of cases, without necessarily going into details?
Well, the first news, of course, would come out, and it meant that all the bargains stood as they were, and then they were unravelled individually, one with another, and then you would be left with balanced positions, which you would have to either sell in the market or look to recovery. It took a long time, and of course it could seriously embarrass you financially in the intervening period. But I would say that it is remarkable that we never ever lost any worthwhile sum of money through a hammering ever. It was partly, I think, through efficient office administration. But also, in the end, you know, most people lived up to their bargains, and the deficiency of capital was probably found from the compensation fund and so forth.
How was Pynchon faring as a firm in the early 70s? Let's say, setting aside at the moment the recession in 1974, say coming up to the recession, late 60s, early 70s, was it profitable?
Very, yes, business? Oh yes, yes, a very profitable business. No, I mean, I can quite definitely say that throughout the period of partnership from 1968, we never ever lost money. I think we had our overheads under control. We had good turnover in the market. The margins were good. A great boost to margins at the period of decimalisation, when that was introduced. It did mean a substantial effective increase in margins. because of the decimalization of the currency being expanded effectively. And just mathematically, you expanded your margins by about, from memory, about 40 to 50%. I mean, it didn't seem very much in real, in pence at the time, but the effect was extremely, extremely good. And then, funnily enough, the 1970s on the bear tack were extremely profitable for the jobbers. It's a technicality of the business, but if you sold a bear, it meant that you had very little capital to, required very little capital to run your book with, because you were never buying stock, you were always selling stock to buy it back later. So provided you could, again, another technicality, borrow the stock and deliver it to your seller, to your buyers, you never had any, you never had a need of an overdraft. So we were short of, we were short of stock, and it was going the right way in the market, in market terms. We had a considerable balance at the bank in credit, so we were winning on both ways. And I think, just, you know, in terms of relative advantage at that moment in time, we had it over the brokers hand over fist, and probably were as financially powerful as ever at that, the end of that period in the 70s. But thereafter, when the market turned and we got back into the into a bull market with the equities, provided you could, you know, keep your inventory right, and I think that's perceived upon this day, the it was profitable. It was sufficient turnover. You know, of course, you got some positions wrong, but by and large, we were always long of stock, and we had some uncomfortable moments, but by and large, we had very good turnover and very good business, and it was very profitable. It wasn't until much later that the structural difficulties in the market became more aware. We became more aware of it, and one could see that the commercial problems of the jobbing system and being a member of it were going to cause difficulties in the later stages. But that was much later on, and those early 70s, well, the whole of the 70s, it was a very profitable business.
Was it about this time that you merged with Denny Brothers?
It was in the early 70s, I think from 1970 or 71, from memory, that we merged with Denny Brothers. And that was the last of the major mergers that we undertook.
Can you remember how that came about? Because I believe Denny Brothers was a firm with more or less the same number of partners. You both had more or less 15 partners in either firm. Was it a sort of an alliance of equals, or was it again a case of one firm taking over another firm that was beginning to flag?
Well, I would like to say that it was the latter, because I think that the senior partners were very much older men, but great experts. Jack Hubbard and George Wicks were both then in the sort of later 60s. Clearly wanted to retire. There was no obvious successor in management for them. But nevertheless, it was an extremely successful firm, and George Wicks was, without a doubt, the most expert man in the investment trust market that probably there will ever be in the stock exchange. He knew it inside out. And so it did come to us as a very whole, complete, very profitable business. And clearly, it was extremely valuable to us to be able to acquire that, and we did so on extremely advantageous terms to the partners of the then Pynchon. They equally had a much broader section of the market to survive upon, but for many years afterwards, the profits from the investment trust market in particular were a great strength and sort of stabilization to our firm's profits. I think it would have been difficult to imagine them having gone on without having merged with us, and I think that it was, as it turned out, a very happy merger. Mm.
Did the office have to expand, back office have
no.
to expand?
No, it was perfectly capable of being carried on within the one. And there I think I should pay tribute to my father in particular, who saw from a very early stage that computerization was absolutely key to streamlining the administration. In fact, we had one of the very first computers in the exchange having gone on from the old International Computers and Tabulators, who put in the original Hollerith machines into our office, which were I think they should be preserved in a glass case, and I'm not so sure that they aren't still around, but nevertheless they did these punch cards which were red, and it was a very efficient method of recording all the entries, which were many, many hundreds in a day. I mean, in 1970 we're doing something like 10,000-11,000 bargains a day in the second steel renationalization, something like 12,000 bargains a day, which when you consider the amount of bargains done by any individual firm now is simply staggering in the volume. And that went on for week after week after week. And without computerization, we simply couldn't have coped with the volumes.
So about this time, the last major round of mergers was taking place. Back office was becoming more sophisticated. You also had the move from the old house through the temporary house to the new house in the early 70s. Did that make a difference to the stock exchange, to the atmosphere, to the way you did business?
Oh yes, I think it did. I mean, obviously, many of us who were sort of younger partners were up in communications and so forth felt that it was all for the good. I think it certainly took away a lot of the character of the house. The waiters of the stock exchange were a marvellous lot of people, and one looks back with great nostalgia at their ability, because they were great trainers of people as well as everything else, and you relied desperately on their good offices to make sure that your firm was promptly called and messages were relayed and delivered. But it was archaic in the old house as to how it was done, with the old ear trumpet and the whistle, which blew down a voice pipe from one end of the building to the other. And if the chap was a bit hard of hearing or not paying attention after lunch, I mean, you could fail to get through for a long, long time. There was no question of walkie-talkies on the floor and all this sort of thing. No, of course, it was more efficient, the new house. Of course it was. And it had to happen, but it lacked the charm of the old.
Do you remember any of the waiters?
Yes, absolutely, yes. Not many of them are alive now, I don't think, but I certainly saw one the other day. He would be now nearly 80. He was a terrific friend of the firm, and he looked very well.
How did the firm now weather the recession in 1974? I imagine that if you're doing a lot of, if one of your main markets was insurance trusts, financial markets, that these would have been stocks that were particularly vulnerable to that kind of recession.
Well, the main enemy of the industrial market, if I want to put it like that, during the sort of 70s and 80s was inflation, because I think the manufacturing industry found it extremely difficult to adjust their commercial attitude to roaring inflation. They simply didn't realize it was happening, that their costings and replacement in terms of changing the direction of the business, in terms of replacement of capital and so forth, was very difficult to account for and price in their businesses. Financial businesses were much more able to keep abreast of inflation and to price themselves out of any problems they got into, and of course the lead times were they had no fixed price contracts like constructors and builders and so forth. So something like the Rolls-Royce crisis, which was basically caused out of I suspect fixed price contracts being entered into and being unhorsed by the rates of inflation, which eventually took over, simply didn't occur in the financial markets. Therefore, the markets in which we were dealing in that aspect were much more in demand. They were really bull markets, and there was people, you know, brokers who were seriously advising their clients to, for instance, sell the motor market and the components market in its entirety and reinvest in the financial markets. And of course it was a very good investment switch.
So in terms of the running of the business or jobbing, it wasn't a particularly harsh time for Pinch and Denny?
No, certainly not, no. No, no, we did well.
Now, when did you become senior partner?
I became, my father died in 1972. My uncle carried on until 1976, I would say, until he himself became really quite ill. And so, although I was not senior partner until 1978, in name I was senior partner from 1976 onwards.
Mm. And what did that entail for you, in terms of your role in the firm?
My role in the firm meant that I completely left the dealing side altogether. And as at the time I was sort of 30, late 30s, sort of early, you know, beginning of the 40s, it was quite hard to actually be kicked upstairs on an administrative role, because by then jobbing firms had become much more structured in terms of organisation and committees and so forth. It had taken on a bureaucracy in order to cope with the difficulties of running a modern commercial business. And so it was with great sadness that I really began to lose touch with the market from then onwards.
Mm-hmm. And did you try and pursue particular policies in terms of the development of the firm?
Yes, yes, very much so, because during the 70s, which was, although we'd prospered quite well, one of the great features was that under the socialist government of that time, inflation really rushing away into hideous proportions, and the funding of the government debt with interest rates rising, tremendous result. The turnover in the equity markets had dwindled in terms of the total turnover of the stock exchange in favour of the gilt market enormously. And I think that if I was to criticise my predecessors, and my father in particular, I would say that they didn't see that happening. They were given the opportunity to enter the gilt market in the 70s. Early 70s, and they decided that they wouldn't do it. We were doing very well at the time. They didn't want to extend themselves. They didn't really understand the fixed interest market. The government broker clearly saw a need for another jobber in the gilt market, that felt that our firm would be the appropriate people to come and ask. Clearly would have helped us in terms of personnel and market showing against the market. But we turned it down, and in retrospect, it was a very bad mistake, because in those 70s we missed out on a colossal volume and a turnover which really promoted two of our competitors, namely Messrs. Wed de Lacquer and Ackroyd and Smithers, really almost head and shoulders from the rest of the market at that time, with a tremendous amount of profitability. And Turner that they'd arrived in the gilt edge market. It was a bad mistake, and it was something that I attempted to put right, because in 1978 we felt that we got to a point where we really had to have a representation in this market, and having researched it really very thoroughly, we did enter the gilt market, and although we were very small operators in it, we did actually have that representation, and it stood us well in the end, and we did make a success of it and made a certain amount of money out of it.
Did you ever consider incorporating?
No, my incorporation was really, again, as I remember, a feature of the early 70s. My father had a very strong view that he wanted to remain a partnership, and I think earlier in the interview I talked about the tremendously strong affinity that there had been between partners, that it was an ideal form of commercial relationship, particularly in a business like jobbing, where you really could lay your colleagues on the line financially if you'd opened your mouth in the wrong way or you'd been commercially imprudent. And it was a tremendous discipline and a great comfort to know that you could work on such a basis. And so my father had always felt that in order to encourage young people into the business, partnership was ideal, because you could admit them with no capital. They didn't have to buy their shareholding from somebody else. So anybody with any ability but no capital could come into the business, provided he could be financed by his other partners. There was one other great advantage of partnership, was that the rules of cessation under the Income Tax Act were such that if your business suffered or was prone to peaks and troughs in absolute profits from one year to another, you could so arrange your tax affairs to take advantage of that. And without going into any great detail, it was possible for partnerships to, as it were, cease and commence their businesses advantageously tax-wise, which was not a cheat in terms of avoiding tax. It was a legitimate measure. But the money so saved from tax, without one shadow of doubt, contributed hugely to the ability of the jobbing system to remain in business. Without the professional advice to work that, the jobbing system would have crashed to the ground a great deal earlier. Mm. Now, with those two points in mind, my father had been very against ever selling the business out. And I think the first firm to sell itself were Smith Brothers, and they took a perfectly a view which was perfectly maintainable, which the proprietors of the business wished to